This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The American financial system has been in trouble, and the reasons why are a little difficult to comprehend. They involve derivatives, credit default swaps, hedge funds, and all sorts of complicated trades that are unlike stocks and bonds. Our guest, Michael Greenberger, can explain how we got into this mess in language that people who aren't finance experts can understand. He served on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission from 1997 to 99, where he directed the Division of Trading and Markets. He was responsible for supervising exchange-traded futures and derivatives. He also served on the steering committee of the President's Working Group on Financial Markets and the International Organization of Securities Commission's Hedge Fund Task Force. He now directs the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he's a professor at the School of Law. Michael Greenberger, welcome to Fresh Air. Why is part of the finance system now being described by so many people as a shadow financial system? That has a nice conspiratorial ring to it.
Well, the reason for that is that most people in their everyday contact with the financial system know about stocks and bonds, and they can open their newspapers and or get on the internet and get pricing information about where a stock is in terms of its price level or what a bond is selling at. And even in the traditional futures market, for people who are hedging, for example, farmers hedging their crops and wanting to lock in a certain price, or even those who want to speculate in the futures market, that's all a transparent market. You can go to your computer, you can go to your newspaper, and you will find out immediately what's going on. And supplementary to that is there is financial reporting about that system. But since the late 1980s, a much more powerful system has developed, and that is called the, and it's often referred to as complex derivatives. And essentially, the banking community developed these products starting in the mid-80s, and it's just developed a herd of steam since that time. And at this point in time, worldwide, there is more money invested in derivative products than there are in stocks and bonds, which usually comes as a great surprise to many people. And these derivative products, when you boil down to their fundamentals, are essentially bets on the direction that certain events will take place. And the most common, for example, is betting on the direction of interest rates, either United States interest rates or worldwide interest rates. And once it's a private contract and one side enters into a bet that the interest rates will go up, and the counterparty or the other side bets, takes the opposite side and bets that they will go down. And those are private transactions. They're not easily made public. You can't open the newspaper and see what's happening. And when you enter into a bet, if you want the bet, the counterparty who takes the opposite end charges you a fee for having that bet. That's a very profitable piece of business for banks and hedge funds to do. And so that's why this is called a shadow system. We don't see it in our day-to-day lives, and it goes on sort of in what people refer to as dark markets.
And there's no regulation?
There is no regulation. In fact, when I was in the government, we argued very strenuously that these kinds of hidden bets could be very disruptive to the financial system. And they played as important a role as securities and bonds did, which are regulated. We wanted them to be regulated. That was a battle that we lost out on. And essentially, in December 2000, on the floor of the Senate, Phil Graham, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, introduced a piece of legislation that completely deregulated these markets, not only at the federal level, but for the most part at the state level. So they are completely outside of the law, so to speak.
And what was this legislation?
It was called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. It was a 262-page bill, and it was added as a rider to an 11,000-page omnibus appropriation bill as Congress was recessing for Christmas in 2000. I would say there was no one except the drafters of the bill who understood what it did. And I can assure you that the drafters of the bill were not members of Congress. They were the lawyers for the investment banks on Wall Street. They convinced Senator Graham to introduce this. They freed the system for any regulation. And we've been embarking on financial fiascos ever since.
And I should mention, Phil Graham is now the chief economic advisor to John McCain in McCain's presidential campaign.
He is the chief economic advisor to John McCain. John McCain famously said quite recently he doesn't really know as much as he should about economics, but he's reading Alan Greenspan's biography. Phil Graham is at his side. Phil Graham is also an officer of UBS, a Swiss bank, that just within these last few days reported losses of in the neighborhood of $12 billion because of these bets.
Now, let me just see if I can understand these credit derivative, these complex credit derivative bets a little bit better. Is credit derivative the right word?
Credit derivative, credit default swaps, OTC derivatives are the words that you will hear when federal financial regulators speak.
It seems to me, if I understand it correctly, and I'm not sure that I do, that, like, say you can invest in a basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There'd be the stock market way of investing in the actual team, but the credit derivative approach would just be betting on whether the team was going to win or lose.
That's a very apt analogy, and that's exactly right. Instead of owning the team, you go and find either a legal or illegal gambling operation, and you try and profit from the team by betting that they will win or betting that they will lose. And in the present crisis, the bets that are at stake are bets on whether people would pay their subprime mortgages off or whether they wouldn't. And for the most part, the banks have bet that those subprime mortgages would be paid off because they thought it was a riskless investment, because housing markets were always going up astronomically, and even people who couldn't afford their mortgages within a matter of months had gained value in their real estate so that that value could be extracted and they would then have money to pay mortgages off that they didn't have to pay off when they started out with the loan. So the banks entered into a series of bets that those subprime mortgages would be paid off. And when you hear that they are losing millions and billions of dollars, it is because those bets have turned bad. And essentially, it's even worse than the fact that they're losing bets. They took these bets, just as, for example, if you went to a basketball game and bet on a team that would win, they took those bets and said, well, these are very valuable bets. We're going to add them as assets to our books. So we think these are so risk-free that they have tremendous value. So when you read a bank's financial statement, that's listed as a very valuable asset. Well, when it turned out that these bets were going to be lost, that bookkeeping had to be redone. And instead of being a valuable asset, it was a very bad liability. And to make matters worse, the federal government permitted these institutions to engage in this betting, not through the bank itself or through the hedge fund itself, but through off-book entities called structured investment vehicles. So for a long time, when the banks were losing this money, they didn't even put it on their balance sheet. And when you hear, for example, that a bank has lost billions of dollars, that is merely the money it has put back on its books. There may be even greater losses in these structured investment vehicles. And the banks have been consistently urged to fess up and tell the world what their losses are so that we can draw a ring around the extent of this problem.
So what you're telling me is a lot of the things that have crashed our economy, they're basically just bets. They're not even about businesses not doing well because their products aren't selling and therefore investors are suffering. This is betting.
It's exactly betting. Now, in some sense, there's financial prudence in this. For example, if you owned the subprime mortgage or the asset value of the subprime mortgage and you were worried about that it might collapse, you would want to pay a very small premium for an insurance policy that if your investment collapsed, you would be insured and you would not lose any money. Well, the bank essentially entered into a bet that it would never have to pay off that insurance. And those are called the credit default swaps. So for a very small amount of money, they effectively gave investors insurance policies that the assets they held, depending on the subprime mortgages, would never lose value. And that's the bet that was made here. And the form of the bet, technically speaking, is a credit default swap. By the way, it sounds an awful lot like an insurance policy, but they don't want to call it insurance because if it's insurance, it's regulated by the states. So they were very careful whenever they wrote these contracts to make clear that the word insurance never appeared. Because if you were doing insurance, the states would then have a very aggressive role to play. And in fact, if I may just add, when they made these bets and they got worried whether they'd be able to pay them off if the subprimes did not, if the subprime mortgagees failed, they went out and got insurance policies to protect the value of their bet. That is to say, if they lost the bet and they had to pay, they were insured against that loss. But when they went to those insurance companies, they said, please don't write us an insurance policy. We want a credit default swap. Why? Because credit default swaps are expressly deregulated by federal statute and cannot be regulated by the federal government or by the states. Now, and the final tragedy, if I might just add,
yeah, go
here,
ahead.
Is the insurance companies thought they were insuring, they thought that this was a risk-free insurance factor. So they gave out insurance faster than they could write it. So you had these very small companies insuring billions and billions of dollars of these bets. And you will read, and 8 weeks ago, we read a lot about these insurance companies are beginning to fail. And the taxpayer has a problem there because most of these insurance companies have guaranteed municipal and state obligations. That is to say, taxpayers have paid to have their public bonds insured by these companies. Now they have failed. The states and cities don't have the insurance they need, and they have to go out and buy insurance from companies who are sound, and there is an additional premium that has to be paid. And state treasurers, for example, the California state treasurer, is beside himself over this problem.
We're talking about how the American financial system got into the mess it's in. My guest is Michael Greenberger. He served on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission from 1997 to 99. He says the trouble isn't over yet.
We are soon going to find out it's not just mortgages, but it's all kinds of loans. Credit card loans, student loans, auto loans are all going to be infected. The same system is at play. And the thing to understand here is that this all started out, it seemed like a wonderful, wonderful idea. The banks were making loans in the form of mortgages. And traditionally, when I took my mortgage out many years ago, the bank was very careful to see that I could pay it off because the bank was going to lose money if I didn't. And what has happened in this system is the banks decided, look, we're going to make the loan, the mortgage loan, we're going to get all the commissions, the fees, the courier service charges, the fax charges, but then we're going to sell the loan to other people through a security. And that's what you hear called mortgage-backed securities. They bundle the loans together, and just like a corporation, investors can buy those securities. Well, when the investors said, wait a minute, if we buy securities for people who can't afford to pay them off, that's a very risky operation. And that's when the bank said, not to worry, we'll effectively insure them. We will guarantee that they'll be paid off for a very small premium. There's no general reporting system. Nobody, including the Fed, can go and say, well, how many of these bad bets are there out there? So, for example, when Bear Stearns went under because of these bad bets, and the American public essentially had to take these bets, these credit default swaps, as collateral, no one else would take them as collateral, just the United States taxpayer, ordered by the Treasury to do so. The United States taxpayer takes it as collateral through the Fed, loans Bear Stearns $30 billion, and within the last few days, the market went up 391 points. People are saying to themselves, wow, the problem's cured. But the next day, people realize, we don't know if Bear Stearns is the mine disaster or the canary in the mine telling us about a much bigger disaster. And that's the problem.
Well, that leads me to something that you said a few moments ago, which I found kind of scary. You said, we've seen what happened with the subprime mortgages, but we haven't yet seen the similar damages with credit card loans and automobile loans.
Student loans.
So,
and also the private equity, all these people who borrowed money to buy these corporations have all essentially followed the same template. Now, obviously, I'm simplifying it for your audience, but really, when you break it down to the fundamentals, whatever my simplification is exactly what's happening. It is as if a bunch of Las Vegas bookies started taking bets and never bothered to write them down or record them. Or, as you know, frequently, a bookie will try and have a balance book so that if it loses one side of the bet, it will cover by another side, and they make their money on the commissions, or the vigor, as they say, I believe. Here, these banks didn't bother to hedge themselves. So, you know, we would have been better off if Las Vegas had handled this operation than having Bear Stearns handle it.
I can't imagine how complicated the math is that goes into figuring out these complicated investment instruments. So in addition to deregulation making this environment possible, probably computers have too, making it possible to keep track of these complicated mathematical formulas and bets.
Well, that's a very interesting query you've made. First of all, the instruments themselves and how they pay off, in other words, who wins or loses, are complicated. But the concept is not complicated. And of course, the American public is totally scratching its head over this and doesn't know what's happening. They see people losing homes, and those people lost homes because the banks really didn't have any risk here. They were making commissions on the mortgages themselves, so they just wanted to write this stuff as fast as they could, and they didn't care whether these people could pay off. So those people who didn't have the wherewithal to pay off have now been foreclosed upon. Neighborhoods have empty houses. People are beside themselves. But it all goes back to the fact that there were these underlying credit default swaps. The American people don't understand that. If Franklin Delano Roosevelt were president right now, we would understand that. There would be a fireside chat. We would make it so that the American public understands it. And it's important that the American public understand it, because even as we speak, the Wall Street interests who have all the money in the world to hire lobbyists are lobbying 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, 366 in leap year, to keep this market, what we began our discussion with, a shadow market that nobody understands. And what they tell Congress is, look, these are complicated things. You are not smart enough to tell us what to do. But the fact of the matter is, what we have seen is these guys aren't smart enough to be able to carry this thing off without regulation. They're losing money hand over fist. And of course, the saddest fact in all this is that when these CEOs lose the money, they're fired, but they walk away with hundreds of millions of dollars in severance packages. And when Bear Stearns collapses, the Fed is prepared to have taxpayer money thrown in to rescue the institution, but no money or relief goes to the person whose mortgage has been foreclosed.
You've explained some of the derivatives and other complicated investment instruments behind the financial problems we've been having in the past few months. And you described how Phil Gramm, when he was a Republican senator from Texas, was behind a Commodity Futures Modernization Act that prevented regulatory agencies from regulating these complicated instruments. Phil Gramm was also behind a bill that was passed in 1999 that overturned a Depression-era bill that regulated investment banks. Tell us a little bit about that bill.
Well, essentially, as a result of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was passed during the Depression, there were two kinds of banks: depository institutions, which are the kind of banks that we're most familiar with, where you go in and you open a checking account and a savings account and you try and get a loan from, and investment banks, which don't take deposits but have investors, and they are responsible for making investments in financial instruments. And the Glass-Steagall Act said that where people are putting their money, their savings, we don't want these guys doing risky kinds of stock market investments. Today, the problem is derivatives. In the 30s, it was stocks, which were not regulated. So we want to separate the two out so people understand when they go to a bank and open a savings account, the bosses of the bank aren't fooling around with the stock market. Well, over time, the banks were not happy with that, and they wore that distinction away. So in 1999, essentially, any distinction between an investment bank and a depository institution was eliminated, and that allowed banks that we're familiar with, like Citibank or Citigroup or Bank of America, Wachovia, to have an arm that does all these fancy investments. And the theory for all of this is that these bankers are very, very smart. They make a lot of money. They dress nicely. They have nice summer homes. They're not going to risk their money. They're smarter than the Congress is. So for years and years and years, the markets have been deregulated. And in fact, earlier this week, Secretary Paulson announced this restructuring of financial regulation. That really started before the subprime mess, and it was the result of Wall Street saying, hey, we are so heavily regulated in the United States, we're losing business to London, and we're no longer going to be the financial center of the world. We need a lighter touch of regulation. And that was set in motion in March of 2007. And essentially what was shocking to me is that Paulson introduces this legislation, which was modeled after the British template, which is light regulation of financial institutions. It has nothing to do with the subprime meltdown. It heads in the other direction of being a lighter regulatory touch. And ironically, the British are reeling from their regulatory system. One of the major banks in Britain, Northern Rock, had a run, a classic Depression-era run, where people lined up outside to get their money out of the bank. They were heavily into the subprime market. The bank virtually collapsed, and the British government had to buy the bank. They nationalized it. So, you know, the irony is the more you argue for deregulation, the more you end up having government-owned entities, which is not good for anybody. It's especially not good for the American taxpayer, because the American taxpayer is buying these banks and instruments and everything else when they had nothing to do with the collapse.
The Fed bailed out Bear Stearns with the explanation that if it didn't, it would have been disastrous for the American economy, possibly for the global economy. Do you think that's a legitimate argument?
I absolutely think it is a legitimate argument. There's no doubt about it. If Bear Stearns had collapsed, it would have been a house of cards, and others would have collapsed, and it wouldn't have just been a United States problem. It would have been a worldwide problem. And so the point is, don't put us in the position where somebody is too big to fail. There was an interesting article in the New York Times, roughly about December 21st, 2007, called "The Fed Shrugged." It's a play on Alan Greenspan's
interesting Ayn Rand, who wrote
Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged. But the point was that Alan Greenspan, when he was there, and Bernanke now, have been warned about this, not just by anybody, but by other people in the Bush administration, that as early as 2001, we had a crisis on our hands. And if the federal government had acted responsibly, this would not have happened. We would be in a very good economy now with job growth and income growth. But yes, that's why when people tell you this is the worst economic crisis since World War II, that's a way of not saying the panicky thing, which is we may be heading for a depression. And if a Bear Stearns collapses, you're going back to 1929, that it's not just going to be Bear Stearns, it's a house of cards. And that's why we don't know. Is Bear Stearns the end? That's why the market went up so much earlier this week, is there's a belief that Bear Stearns is the end. There are some of us who are very worried that Bear Stearns is the beginning and not the end. And if we needed $30 billion to bail out Bear Stearns, and there are others that start collapsing and need to be rescued so we don't go into a total abyss, it's going to be a major crisis. So they did the right thing when they faced the ultimate crisis. Where they were wrong is not responding to the clear signals going all the way back to 2001 that this was going to happen if the Fed didn't intervene sooner.
Now, a lot of people are saying if the Fed and the taxpayer is going to bail out an investment bank, then the government should have the right to regulate investment banks, just as the government regulates commercial banks. So what are some of the proposals on the table now to do that?
Well, frankly, I just have to be quick to answer that I don't think there's any effective proposal on the table. First of all, my own view is that between the two pieces of legislation, the more famous one, which was eliminating the distinction between investment banks and commercial banks, was the least problematic. The lesser known piece of legislation that Phil Graham sponsored, which had no hearings in the Senate, no Senate report, came up on the floor, was really just a complete surprise to everybody, is this deregulation of these instruments, the credit default swaps, OTC derivatives, et cetera. My basic view is I don't care who the institution is, whether it's a bank, an investment bank, a hedge fund, a private investor. What I care about is that these are toxic investments that have been deregulated without any forethought at all, except forethought by Wall Street. Warren Buffett famously said that these OTC derivatives, credit default swaps, are the financial equivalent of weapons of mass destruction. Now, he found that out because he bought a company that he did not realize when he bought it was heavily involved in all these derivatives, and he had to unwind them, and it took years and years, and he lost a lot of money. And he has become one of the foremost advocates for regulating these products. There's a lot of discussion about helping homeowners. The Senate is now apparently, there's been some kind of compromise reached. And helping homeowners is great. It needs to be done. But what also needs to be done is to eliminate the ability for banks and other lenders not to worry whether the loan they're making is going to be paid off. What has happened is that it's removed financial discipline from the market. And the people who do these loans are making all the money on the commissions from the loan transaction itself. They could care less about the interest rate being paid. And then they want to shift the loan out into the economy and have others worry about it. And that has removed the kind of solid discipline that lenders usually employ. That was the historic way that financial discipline played itself out in the system. But once you took the worry about whether the loan would be repaid out of the system, these lending institutions, all they wanted to do was make these transactions. So they falsified papers and everything else, let people submit unverified information, getting these loans out the door. And now the piper has been paid. My view is that was all done because they had these tricky little instruments that they thought would save the day. They didn't. They're the heart of the problem. And what we need to go back to was where life was on November 2000 when these instruments were subject to regulation.
You said that Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, that his new proposal to regulate financial systems in the United States is actually more like deregulation than more regulation. Would you explain that?
Well, that's absolutely true. And as I said earlier, it arises from a pre-meltdown scenario where the economy was doing rather well and the investment interests on Wall Street wanted to be regulated less harshly by the United States government. And they put in motion this review of financial architecture of the United States. And Paulson grabbed onto it hook, line, and sinker and started this study. And what the report was earlier this week was the end result of a study that was done before the meltdown occurred. And by Paulson's own admission, was not written with an eye towards solving the problems that we're facing on a day-to-day basis right now. And the reason it is a deregulatory measure is it puts all the responsibility ultimately in the hands of the Fed. It does not give the Fed the power to prevent problems from happening. It gives the Fed power to deal with problems as they occur. In other words, taking Bear Stearns as an example, the Fed wouldn't have had the power to deal with Bear Stearns as it was getting into its problems. But once Bear Stearns wanted to call a timeout to avoid financial disaster, at that point, the Fed would intervene and do all these investigations and look at their books and everything else. It takes power away from the states and their regulatory abilities, and because of that, the state's attorney generals, insurance commissioners are very upset about this. It takes, in a very complicated and deft way, it takes power away from the SEC by telling the SEC that you've been regulating too restrictively and you have to have a much lighter touch. And the within 6 hours of him announcing this, there were so many vested interests that were challenged, the states, the SEC, even the Fed in the end started making noises that while it became the super cop, it would have less tools available to it if the proposal were not adopted.
Is there a counter proposal?
Well, there are. First of all, it seems to me that the Paulson proposal is virtually dead on arrival. And my own view is that Paulson damaged himself very seriously by engaging in this effort. I mean, it's like saying, like being in the middle of World War II and talking about how you're going to rearrange the Pentagon after the war is over, rather than saying, how are we going to defeat the Nazis and the Japanese? And I just to emphasize that point, when Congress went out on recess, they got earfuls about the people being upset, worried about this problem, the foreclosures. The Bear Stearns bailout has really touched a nerve. And even the Republicans have come back upset. Bernanke had to meet with House Republicans yesterday because they believe this could be a political catastrophe for the Republican Party because it's their watch. But unfortunately, as we sit here today, the proposals that are on the table, I believe, are mere Band-Aids. And I think as this problem gets worse and worse, unfortunately, we have to wait for that to happen. We will start getting more serious proposals from Congress on how to deal with it.
I have a question that maybe only a person who doesn't really understand the finance system would ask. And that is, so where's all the money that disappeared? I mean, there were so many investment banks where each of the banks lost billions of dollars. So where's the money? Does somebody else have it? Did this money ever exist in the first place?
That's a very interesting question, and it's a good question. And the answer is yes, someone has it. These were bets. Some people won those bets. And there are financiers, there's a man named Paulson, no relation to the Secretary of the Treasury, who, if my memory serves, made $10 billion in 2007 betting that the subprime mortgages wouldn't be paid off. So yes, people have pulled money out of the economy. They're not being, obviously under the Bush tax cuts, they're not putting it back in. They're not using it to create companies and employ people. So, yes, there are winners in this. In fact, Goldman Sachs over the summer of 2007 was wise enough to say to itself, hey, betting that the subprimes would pay off is not a good bet. And they reversed their betting position and they bet that they wouldn't pay off. And so Goldman Sachs came out of 2007 in relatively good shape. That, to me, makes a point. Should we have an economy based on whether people make good or bad bets? Or should we have an economy where people build companies, create manufacturing interests, do inventions, advance the American society, make it more productive? This economy is based on people sitting at their computers making bets all day long. Now, they call it credit default swaps, OTC derivatives, asset-backed securities, et cetera, all makes it very complicated. But we are rewarding people for sitting at their computers and punching in bets. That's not the way this economy is going to be built. And India and China, with their focus on science and industry and building real businesses, are going to eat our lunch unless the American public wakes up and puts an end to an economy that praises and makes heroes out of speculators.
You know, while we're talking about deregulation and how that's affected the economy, there's such a revolving door in Washington between people in politics and industries of various sorts. But there has been a revolving door between government and the financial industry. Can you give us a few recent examples of that?
Well, I'll give you a prime example. Before the deregulatory legislation went into effect that essentially told Wall Street and hedge funds and banks, go ahead, do these credit default swaps. Nobody's going to regulate you. You can do whatever you want. We won't even keep track of what you're doing. There was a very strong argument that those products should have been regulated by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, my old home. And in fact, I was part of an effort that said in 1998, when we'd already had 22 episodes of problems with regard to these products, that something must be done. While I was there, a very nice person who's a lot of fun to be with, who had essentially been in the cattle industry in Mississippi and was a friend of the two Mississippi senators, was made a commissioner of the CFTC. He did not know a lot about commodities. He was very open to tell people that. For the first year, he said absolutely nothing at any meetings, but he ultimately rose to be the chair of the CFTC. He was very supportive of deregulating these instruments. When he left the CFTC, he became the president of NYMEX, which is one of the most successful futures exchanges in the United States. And I believe last year he made several million dollars in bonuses. NYMEX is about to be bought out. I'm sure he'll make a very comfortable living from buying his stock in a sale. There are one example after another. The lesson that is conveyed generally to people who go into some of these positions is help Wall Street out and Wall Street will help you out in the end. And, you know, you're sitting here talking to a dummy who didn't take that advice. I'm just a poor professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. But the revolving door and the ability to revolve out the door is a tremendous temptation for those in government to be cheerleaders for deregulation as opposed to seriously trying to get at the bottom of the matter.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Michael Greenberger served on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. He now directs the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he's a professor of law. Many people have been speculating about whether Barack Obama's recent speech in Philadelphia was the beginning of a national conversation about race. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been wondering exactly what national conversations are and when we started talking about them.
Just so we're straight on this, all that Barack Obama actually said in his speech in Philadelphia a few weeks ago was that race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now. He didn't call for a national conversation or a national dialogue on race, or for that matter, for a national discussion, debate, confabulation, or powwow. Still, Obama didn't have to say the words for others to hear them. The Los Angeles Times praised him for redefining our national conversation about race and politics, while the Philadelphia Inquirer asked, who better to lead a national conversation on the subject? And Obama's conservative critics heard the same message, though they were more skeptical about the enterprise. In his New York Times column, William Crystal wrote, the last thing we need now is a heated national conversation about race. Let's not, and say we did. But these days, it's natural to assume that any subject worth thinking about deserves to have a national conversation all its own. Hillary Clinton kicked off her campaign by announcing that she was starting a national conversation about how to get the country back on track. Newt Gingrich has called for a national conversation on aging, and Condoleezza Rice has called for one on trade. And other people have issued appeals for national conversations about climate change, youth sports coaching, the future of classical music, marijuana laws, health care, and personalized learning. The phrase is meant to conjure up that famous Norman Rockwell painting of a New England town meeting where ordinary citizens gather as equals to hash over the affairs of the day. Back in the 1930s, George Gallup claimed that polling and the modern media had recreated those meetings on a national scale. As he put it, the nation is literally in one great room. Of course, when you get that many people talking in one room, it's hard to tell if everybody's paying attention. But by the time the phrase national conversation entered the language in the 1970s, the simulated public forum had become the model for a new bunch of media formats. Jimmy Carter staged the first ersatz town meeting in the 1976 presidential campaign, the format that later found its Pavarotti in Bill Clinton. As it happens, that was also when Phil Donahue was pioneering tabloid talk TV, and when Larry King launched the first national radio call-in show. There was something reassuring about the idea of everybody participating in a vast, extended conversation, particularly for a country trying to get past the angry divisions of Vietnam in the 60s. As the alternative therapies of the era were teaching us, no conflict was so rancorous that it couldn't be dispelled by open conversation, so long as people were honest about expressing their real feelings. True, we probably shouldn't be calling these discussions conversations at all. A genuine conversation has no purpose. It's about the pleasures of merely circulating. The philosopher Michael Oakeshott described conversation as an unrehearsed intellectual venture. It has no determined course. It does not have a conclusion. And it's always a little disconcerting when somebody calls for a conversation about a specific topic. We have to have a little conversation about all those calls to Toledo. It sounds like an appeal for an open exchange of views, but you know that most of the script has already been written. Still, nowadays, you're always hearing conversation used for exchanges that are entirely purposeful, particularly when they're designed to give people the impression that they're coming of their own free will to a conclusion that has actually been determined in advance. You get this a lot from consultants who earn a tough living by coming up with sentences like, we aim to lead the strategic conversation around value alignment. Not to be a stickler about it, but any discussion you can describe as strategic probably doesn't count as a conversation. The preposition itself gives the game away. Around is the new about. It's time for a new national conversation around healthcare. That isn't how we talk about our everyday chit-chat. We were just having a conversation around our favorite seafood joints. And when you hear people call for a national conversation, you always know how they expect it to turn out. Every so often, a foundation or the National Endowment for the Humanities will take the idea at face value and bring groups of citizens together in church basements or PBS stations for a heart-to-heart about race or American identity. But that rarely makes much of a ripple. And in any case, just calling for a national conversation usually makes the point all by itself. Both the Clintons understand this, and so does Newt Gingrich. And William Bennett has called for half a dozen national conversations over the course of his career without ever feeling that he had to pretend to be a good listener. Actually, what's usually most informative in all this is the debate about whether to have those conversations in the first place. If you really want to know what Americans think about race, punch national conversation and Obama into Google News or one of the blog search engines. You'll get an earful, and the subject being race, the tone often falls short of what you'd call conversational. If we ever did get to the point where we could really conduct a national conversation about race, we probably wouldn't need to.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.